From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Taylor Swift is suddenly political. How could that affect her career and the midterms? Then director Paul Greengrass says his film about a 2011 massacre in Norway is instructive in how the country responded.
How Norway fought for her democracy in a moment of supreme crisis, I thought was a story relevant to all of the democracies in the West, my country, your country, across Europe, today and tomorrow.
In a theater experience inspired by church, only this gathering worships art. All that coming up today on The Frame. Taylor Swift is one of the biggest pop stars in the world. She has been apolitical her entire career, but a few days ago, that all changed. In a post to her 112 million Instagram followers, she endorsed Tennessee's Democratic Senate candidate Phil Bredesen and Democratic House candidate Jim Cooper while bashing Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn in the process. She explained ending her political silence by writing, quote, "Due to several events in my life and in the world in the past 2 years, I feel very differently about that now." Michael Wood is the LA Times music critic. When we spoke, I began by asking him what events Swift might have been talking about.
With Taylor, we're always left to read the tea leaves a little bit. You know, here's an artist who hasn't done an interview in a long time, so she doesn't make these things super clear. I think the common wisdom, and I think it's right, is that the personal stuff she's talking about is most likely her court case, where she sued a Denver radio DJ who she said groped her during a meet and greet. I think a thing that's important to note is that she only sued him after he sued her for saying that she had caused him to lose his job, and then she won the case. So I think that's probably what she's referring to. She's had this, you know, dehumanizing experience that naturally made her look at things differently. And then as far as the sort of the world events, I don't know. I mean, I think you can't discount the fact that she put the statement out right after the Kavanaugh hearings.
Yeah, and Marsha Blackburn, we should say, in the House, has not had a great record in terms of voting for pay equity and sexual and gender discrimination.
I think one of the most amazing things about the statement was how hard she went in on Blackburn. I mean, it's one thing to say, vote for this person, vote for this person. It's another thing to say, do not vote for this person for these reasons. Taylor was really forthright, quite detailed. You know, I'm sure Blackburn would take issue with the way that Taylor represented her record. But as far as an upstart wading into this kind of stuff, this is like, wow.
Broadly speaking, what do musicians have to gain and lose by taking these kinds of positions? Donald Trump said of Taylor Swift, let's just say I like Taylor's music about 25% less now. Okay. What are the risks? What are the rewards?
I think it depends on the artist. I mean, the thing that struck me about Taylor is that this is someone who has a very large red state following. This is not someone who's playing only to a coastal progressive audience. So for her, it is a risk. For her, she's risking alienating people who don't share her politics. And look, I mean, we saw this with Taylor. There was a huge backlash on social media after she did this, people talking about how appalled they are that she would come out and betray these sort of heartland values. So I don't think that every artist has a lot to lose, but I think Taylor did.
There's a long feud between Kanye West and Taylor Swift that dates back to the MTV Movie Awards. Is there any way to read what she's doing in contrast or in reaction to Kanye West's endorsement of Donald Trump on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Taylor's one of the savviest operators out there in terms of sort of how to conduct a career in pop. So you can safely assume that she knew coming out when she came out would be interpreted as this sort of proxy war. Was it a motivating impulse? I don't know. I mean, the thing about the Instagram post that struck me was how earnest it was. Like, there's been a lot of calculations in Taylor's career. And look, this is not calculated. It came right before she was on the American Music Awards, which is like a big media look. It came right before Grammy voting starts. And, you know, she's obviously gunning for nominations for her Reputation album. So it's not like she wasn't taking all this into account. But I don't know. The idea, like, did she want to get into it again with Kanye in this way? I'm not sure. I haven't decided yet.
Last night, Swift performed at what we know to be your favorite award ceremony of the year, the American Music Awards. She took home the prize for Artist of the Year, Tour of the Year, Pop Rock Album of the Year. And I don't even talk about what record she set because that would give the AMAs more credit than they deserve. But when she took the stage in front of a big TV audience, she spoke, and here's what she said.
Thank you so much for this. And I just wanted to make a mention of the fact that this award and every single award given out tonight were voted on by the people. And you know what else is voted on by the people? Is the midterm elections on November 6th. Get out and vote. I love you guys.
So she didn't make any endorsement. What would you say about what she said and the fact that she went back to her voter registration push?
I mean, look, you know, a little bit is a lot at something like the American Music Awards. Would I have liked to have seen something a little bit more pronounced? Yeah, of course. It's better TV. It's more interesting. It advances the story a little bit more. But, you know, she said something, which is more than the vast majority of others did on the show.
Do you think this is it for now, or do you think she's going to continue to flex her political voice?
Yeah, I'm super interested to see how this goes. And not just what she sort of says on social media. I want to know how this impacts her music. I mean, I think Taylor has been known for someone who's writing sort of directly from the particulars of her personal life, her romantic life, her social life. And this whole little chapter, this whole shift for her, it starts to make me think, maybe Taylor is thinking about her art in a different way, that she's going to start using her records as an opportunity, a platform to talk about other stuff. Now, do I want her to become Bono? God, no. I certainly do not want that. But I'm intrigued by the idea that Taylor might start writing from a different point of view, or might just sort of be expanding what she wants to write songs about.
Michael Wood is the LA Times music critic. Michael, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Same to you, John. Thanks a lot.
I never trust a narcissist, but they love me. So I play them like a violin, and I make it look oh so easy.
Coming up, filmmaker Paul Greengrass uses the power of storytelling to remember and work through tragic events.
This is how the world works. Now all he thinks about is me. I can feel the flames.
Filmmaker Paul Greengrass may be best known for the Jason Bourne movies, but there's another genre of film that occupies his attention, and those are movies focused on real and violent attacks around the world. He made Bloody Sunday, about British soldiers opening fire on unarmed Irish protesters in 1972, which killed 14. Greengrass also directed United 93, about the hijacked plane that went down over Pennsylvania on 9/11, and Captain Phillips, about a naval hijacking by Somali pirates. And now, the just-released 22 July. This new film tells the horrific story of a right-wing white supremacist who exploded a truck bomb in Oslo, then took a ferry to a nearby island where teenagers were at a political youth camp and opened fire. 77 people were killed that day, and many more were injured and affected. The perpetrator is currently in jail. When I sat down with Paul Greengrass, he started with why he wanted to tell this story.
I made the film because the story of what happened afterwards, how Norway responded to this attack, how Norway fought for her democracy in a moment of supreme crisis, I thought was a story relevant to all of the democracies in the West, my country, your country, across Europe, today and tomorrow, because I think we are in a dangerously unmoored moment, a moment in the evolution of Western democracy where once again populist forces, protectionist forces, hard right-wing forces are raging like a typhoon through the West and are supported, of course, by many, many millions of people for entirely understandable reasons. But there are dangers with that.
A lot of your film is about what happens after the massacre. The massacre mm-hmm. really ends about 30 minutes into the story. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the film is about the perpetrator.
I have started a war to take back control of Norway, of the West. And defending me will be the greatest thing you'll ever do.
Although it's my duty to take this case, I don't agree with what you've done today, Mr. Breivik. They're innocent. Children?
They were traitors. Children of the elite. The leaders of tomorrow.
What the film makes very clear is that he wanted attention. And that was largely his motivation for the attacks. Mm-hmm. So how do you tell his story and what he believed without celebrating his narcissism and the ideas mm-hmm. that a lot of people find attractive in what he was motivated by?
I felt two things very strongly. I remember reading his testimony at the trial, in which he talked about the betrayal of democracy by the elites, the sham of democracy, that the elites had embraced globalism and enforced multiculturalism on a Norway that was resistant to it, that identity was being eroded. That a ragbag of prejudices, but a clear intellectual worldview, if I can put it that. I mean, he's many things, but he's certainly an intelligent person. Grew up in an affluent West Oslo household. Father was a diplomat. So it's a coherent worldview. As I read it, it was eerie because I thought, well, these opinions, this worldview, would have been considered in 2011 when he was in court, or 2012, to be on the far margins of political discourse. But reading it today, those opinions, that worldview, that's standard for your right-wing populist today in Europe, in North America.
No, in Poland especially now.
Not just Poland, Hungary,
right.
Austria, yeah. where you have a neo-Nazi party holding the balance of power, Sweden, where you have a literal neo-Nazi party holding the balance of power, in the UK, in France, in Italy, of course, you have a hard right government. Now, it's important, and when we discuss these things, to use language carefully. I am not saying, and I do not believe, that those kinds of politicians agree with what this man did. They do not. Obviously, they do not. And it would be unfair of me to suggest that. But what is true is that his rhetoric, his worldview now, is in the mainstream. And that's just in the last 6 or 7 years.
We're talking with Paul Greengrass, the writer and director of the new film, 22 July. One of the first things, I think the very first thing listed in your credits for special thanks, is the 22 July Family Support Group. Mm-hmm. There are people who clearly were unhappy or uncomfortable with the idea of this film being made. And there are people who participated in its making. What were the concerns? How did you address the concerns? And what was the most important thing that the survivors and their families and the families of the victims wanted to make sure that you got right?
I would say that the idea of this film got very, very considerable support. I'm not sure it's true that there was criticism in the way you say. Certainly the first thing that I did was to go and see the family support group. It's a very well-organized organization. There's a national board and there are 15 or 16 chapters around Norway. It's a highly organized group, and I went and asked permission, which is what you should do. And of course, they, more than anybody, any other group of people, know about the threat, the rising threat from this violent hard right. They, I would say, almost to a person, and there are some thousands of them, because of what they live through, see it. And they join up the dots. They see very clearly that a neo-Nazi party now holds the balance of power in the Swedish parliament as of 3 weeks ago. And a virtual neo-Nazi party holds the balance of power now in Austria. You've got Hungary, you've got a hard right party in Italy, you've got political developments in the UK, you've got what's going on in the US. So they put all this together and they say, we need to look at this. And so that's
that why this film is a reminder.
Correct. And that's why they've been so strongly supportive. And from first moment to this, and the film has been taken around Norway, and we've had 15 or 16 screenings for all those groups, and they have been strongly supportive. And I mean, people can take a view on the film and was this done well on that one, but I think the idea that the film should be made and that other, by the way, other films should be made and that that this event needs to be discussed and talked about, whether in films or documentaries or books or newspapers or radio shows. This problem is the problem of the next generation. It's got to be discussed.
You focus very closely on one survivor of this attack who was horribly disfigured and injured in the massacre. As you document in the film, he is obviously suffering from the memory of what happened to him through nightmares, through not only his physical injuries, but the mental wounds that he carries. Mm-hmm. When you talk to somebody like that about your desire to revisit that, how do you reach common ground over what he wants to have memorialized and how difficult revisiting this experience is for him on a daily basis?
Well, I would say a number of things. I think that he is an uncommonly courageous young man with a powerful intellect and a powerful sense of hope and a desire to make his way in politics, and I believe he will. And he is also part of a broad group of many hundreds of young people who survived that attack who feel the same way. I mean, I could have made this exact same film with many of the same scenes with any one of those families, you know, and in many ways I specifically tried to make it that, of course, it's the story of that family, but it's the story of any of those families. I think that you talk to people in an honest way. You accept that your film can't do everything. No one film can tell the whole story of this any more than one film can tell the whole story of 9/11. When these events happen, over time they're explored. We make sense of them and we find different meanings over time, and that's a healthy thing. What counts is, with a film like this, that you ask permission and that you make it with a good and serious heart, and that you, in the end, understand as a filmmaker that your film must speak for itself and be judged. I think that all of us, all that wonderful cast of Norwegian actors, all that wonderful Norwegian crew that I was blessed and lucky to work with, we tried to find the meanings that we saw in this event, and the meanings that we saw were that Norway, particularly her young people and particularly her institutions, fought for her democracy. And that's a story that should inspire all of us across the West today and tomorrow.
Paul Greengrass is the writer and director of 22 July. Paul, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
July 22 is on Netflix and in select theaters now. Coming up in this fractured world, we might need the secret city now more than ever. We'll take you there when The Frame continues after this break. And now Sunday mornings are a spiritual time of the week for many people as they head off to their various houses of worship. It can be a time when we separate ourselves from others based on what we do and do not believe. But there's one place where people can gather on Sundays that's not part of any religion or belief system, and everyone is welcome. And what's worshipped is art. The Secret City is a theater experience that's part cabaret, part joyful tent revival. Marcos Najera has our story.
Let me tell you my big secret. I love the Secret City. A few years ago, I got invited to come sing in their choir. Now, I had no idea what it was. All I was told was, imagine a diverse underground artistic community getting together on a Sunday morning to celebrate creativity and each other through the craft of theater. Well, you know I was down for that. But it wasn't long before I learned the mastermind behind this project was LA theater veteran Chris Wells.
I very much believe in theater. I mean, I will always think of myself as an actor and a person who makes theater and performs. I guess I felt that the theater I was making wasn't really addressing the community, and the community wasn't really engaging with the theater. And
that frustration got Wells thinking about how to stretch himself as an artist. So he started talking to friends like Leslie Tamarabucci, a CalArts faculty member and current Secret City board member.
So I remember a couple of just coffee dates that we had in the mid-late 90s where he would just brainstorm about, like, well, what if
Tamarabucci says those coffee talks about how to use theater as a tool led to sort of small tea parties in Silver Lake, where more creative people would join in on the jam sessions.
There was a lot of conversation about church and ritual and the idea of organizing this gathering around, like, a church service, but then we had a lot of conversation about how people felt about the idea of church, what people's experiences of church were, and whether that was an attractive word to use.
But in 2003, the idea for Secret City got put on hold. Chris Wells was done with L.A. He had fallen in love with his boyfriend, the painter Robert Lucy, and the couple moved to New York.
I didn't really find the community there that I was looking for, and I also was doing a lot of regional theater, and I was not feeling that engaged by the theater I was making. And I realized that I wasn't that satisfied living on the road and living out of a suitcase, and that was a huge
But what did satisfy him were the memories of those L.A. brainstorm sessions and intimate salons with friends, where people would bring a poem, a story, or a song to share. So, Chris and Robert rented a small studio space in Lower Manhattan and picked up where they left off in L.A. The word quickly spread, and soon, the Secret City was holding theater church once a month in New York. Since 2007, these raucous services have brought together thousands of art lovers with the artists themselves. In any given Secret City, presentations can come from painters, poets, bubble blowers, chefs, Aztec dancers, fashion designers, you name it. And just like in a traditional church, each ceremony is rooted in the sermon. At Secret City, the man of the cloth is Chris Wells, although his cloaks tend to have sparkly sequins and glitter and fantastic feathers. Fabulous. And his homilies come from his real-life stories. The gospel, according to Wells, comes with lots of ritual. There's even dedicated time for silent prayer. But at this service, prayer takes the form of whole group meditation. In 2010, Chris Wells scored an Obie Award. It's a special honor given for off-Broadway theater. And in this case, Wells received a special citation for creating The Secret City. Since 2012, Wells and company have gone bi-coastal, staging shows in New York and right back here in L.A., where it all started. At a recent service where the theme was freedom, filmmaker Laura Nix showed a clip from her next documentary. She's following an Asian couple in their mid-60s named Millie and Paul Gao. The pair showed off their ballroom dancing skills live in front of a very surprised but excited Secret City audience.
And when they finished, I mean, I get like chills thinking about it now. The entire audience stood up, gave them a standing ovation, and just went completely crazy for them because I think they got it.
Being with other people is actually, I think there's salvation in that. I think that's how we're going to be able to move forward, is if we can actually be with other people in real time and space.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
The Secret City returns to L.A. this Sunday at noon with a show at the Ford Amphitheater in Hollywood. And that's The Frame for today. You can find us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We're at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back here tomorrow.